Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. And welcome to episode 149 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and as always, I'll be your host today. On today's episode, I have a really special one. I'm joined by the wonderful author, Colin Douglas. Colin's book, The Caribbean and the Second World War, came out earlier this year, and I will be speaking to him in this episode all about the history of the Caribbean when it comes to the Second World War and the longer military histories in the region. Now, as some of you will be aware, this was an episode that was supposed to be live at the Imperial War Museum. Unfortunately, that event was postponed. But I felt like we needed this conversation to happen sooner rather than later. So myself and Colin jumped on the mics virtually to have this conversation and talk about his book, The Caribbean and the Second World War, published by Lawrence Wishart, who I must shout out for their support in this whole process and in kind of setting up this conversation with Colin. Within his text, he describes the pivotal role of the Caribbean during the war and the impact the war had on the region. He's written widely on this topic and also lectured as well. His first book, West Indian Women at War, which we speak about a little bit in the interview, which came out in 1991, which was co-authored with the late Ben Busquet, has been widely referenced by myself as well, which is why I thought it was so cool that I could sit down and talk to Colin, because it was a book that I referenced quite heavily during my master's. In 1988, he produced a widely acclaimed pamphlet entitled 40 Winters On, by Lambeth Council, in partnership with Lambeth Council, which was the first major publication on the history of the arrival in 1948 of the Empire Windrush, which is a symbol of the start of post-war migration from the Caribbean. Colin is the descendant of parents who emigrated to Britain from Jamaica in the 1950s, and after graduating from Oxford University in 1985, he has had a distinguished career in the public services. He was a member of the National Management Board of the NHS. Prior to this, he had been on the management board of Transport for London and was an executive director of the Health and Safety Executive. Colin's work, as you can see, doesn't just span historical research. You know, he's worked extensively within the city and within management and public services. And I'm just so happy to have him on the podcast today. So without further ado, my interview with Colin. Today, welcome Colin Douglas.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be joining you on this.
No, I'm excited. So for those of you that don't know, although I have spoken about this book before on this podcast, so if you are a real listener, you will definitely know what I'm talking about. Colin Douglas is an author and an author of his newest book, which is The Caribbean and the Second World War, published by Lawrence Wishart early this year in 2024. And it describes the pivotal role that the Caribbean played during the war, and also a longer history of the kind of military presence and experience in the Caribbean. And so we're going to be speaking about that text specifically today, and just a kind of military, like long military history in the Caribbean, and the ways in which the Caribbean contributed to the Second World War, like in manpower and economic power, but also the way that this history has been somewhat erased, I would say, in the kind of public memory when we think about the Caribbean and World War II. So, Colin, how did you become interested in the topic of the Caribbean and their either their inclusion into the World Wars or history more broadly?
Yeah. So, firstly, as a second generation Jamaican, my parents came over in the 50s. So I have a natural interest and kind of affinity to Caribbean history. But what really pricked my interest in this period in Caribbean history was during the 40th anniversary of the arrival of the Empire Windrush in 1988. I was working for Lambeth Council and I was responsible for coordinating a range of events to celebrate the anniversary of the Windrush, and that included receptions, exhibitions, essay writing competitions, and also a pamphlet called 40 Winters On, which was a 48-page pamphlet of oral histories of passengers who came over with the Windrush. And a number of them were ex-servicemen, people like Sam King, and also people like Baron Baker, who actually came over before the war. He wasn't a Windrush passenger, he was here when the Windrush arrived, and he was part of the reception party for them. And so that got me interested in, well, that element of Caribbean contribution to the Second World War, which led me and a friend, Ben Busquet, to write our first book, which was the West Indian Women, about West Indian women in the Second World War, called West Indian Women at War. And initially it was going to be more of a kind of a visual book, more of a pictorial book, looking at images with extended captions. But actually, as we dug more and more, we found there was quite a history, and quite a hidden history, to the Caribbean's contribution and the role of West Indian women in the war. So that turned into a book. Since then, I've been meaning to write an even broader history about the Caribbean contribution. And so this was the book that that I've been meaning for some time to write. And unfortunately, my friend Ben Busquet passed many years ago, and so was not able to join me on the journey of writing this book. And so that's how I've developed and become really engrossed in the history of the Caribbean and the Second World War.
Brilliant. And, you know, rest in peace, Ben Busquet, but it was that book that you mentioned that piqued my interest into these histories. And I'm sure listeners will know I did my master's looking at the Auxiliary Territorial Service and their contribution during World War II, and that kind of allowing for women's migration post-war and in this Windrush generation that you're speaking of. So I'm really grateful for both of your contribution to the scholarship, because I think I stumbled upon the book at the Black Cultural Archives in their library. Didn't intend to go to the archives for that purpose that day, but it, you know, changed the kind of academic course of my work. So very, very grateful. I'm assuming an answer to this question, because everyone I ask says a similar thing. But did you learn anything about the Caribbean's contribution to World War II in school? And did this impact, you know, your choices to write on it as well?
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, even though my school, I went to a comprehensive called Tulsall School in Brixton, and at the time that I went there, actually, it was quite ahead of the time in terms of starting to incorporate Black history into the history curriculum. But it was in a very kind of narrow sense, and so there was a fair amount about the history of slavery. But I don't recall anything about the contribution of West Indians in the Second World War. One of the history teachers at the school later in my time there, Donald Hines, made a really kind of significant contribution to the push to get a broader perspective on Black and including Caribbean history into school history lessons. But you know, he was young in his teaching career when he started at Tulsall, and he really kind of developed his role in shaping the curriculum later on in his career. So short answer, no. Things are better now, but they still can improve a lot.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you want to speak a little bit more about, well, why are these histories, these wartime histories, so important, whether that's in Britain or kind of in a wider sense of understanding history?
Yeah, because they are all of our histories. So the Caribbean contribution to the Second World War is not just Caribbean history. It is British history. It is global history. When you ignore it, you ignore part of our collective history. this was a pivotal role. Yeah. And it is quite stunning the degree to which it is not recognised as a pivotal role. But it's also reflective of how narrow the focus is around the kind of narrative of the Second World War history, when the Caribbean's role, significant as it has been, can be so diminished. And I think there are a number of reasons why you see that in history. One of the things that we see in Caribbean history is that there is overt racism. There has been overt racism in the way that the history of the Caribbean has been told, has been mistold, and has been suppressed. But the other thing is that I just think that there is a degree of laziness that because global history, particularly things like the Second World War, which are big, complex, interconnected histories, because they are so complicated, actually, there's a requirement to kind of simplify, to go for the big themes, to kind of dumb down. And so, and in doing that, you get simplistic, lazy narratives that are easy to grasp, but they're so hypersimplified that they ignore vast chunks of the story. And of course, the chunks of the story that they ignore are the chunks that don't speak to the national egos of the main powers that won the war. And actually, as we start to elaborate on the history and to talk more broadly about wider contributions, we shine a light on the wider context, the wider complexity, and the interesting stories of history that have been ignored.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really interesting point, actually, about kind of oversimplifying things. And in this oversimplification, like whose story or what parts of the bigger narrative get missed out or get, like, you know, pushed aside as kind of seemingly unimportant. One thing I really enjoyed about the book is how kind of far back it goes, even to tell the story of something that is a little bit, well, I don't know, my medievalist friends would probably call this more contemporary, but 1945 and you know, World War II history is far enough back for me. But, you know, you go all the way back to the 17th century. And I think specifically there was a note about Michael Crantin's findings about these 75 rebellions between 1638 and 1837, and almost a third of them are coming from Jamaica. There's this spirit of rebellion, and in my study of the Caribbean, even in the kind of 18th and 19th century, and in parts of the 20th century with the labour rebellions, there is, a spirit of rebellion, this spirit of revolt that shows a clear willingness of people to fight for whether what's right, what they believe in, for the betterment of society. And I wonder how much you kind of found that in your research.
Yeah, and that was that's a theme, it's a thread that runs through the history of the Caribbean since European conquest and battles, and it absolutely is a theme that then played out during the Second World War, that played out in that critical decade of the 1930s leading up to the Second World War, where Britain was anxious about whether the rebellions of the 1930s would settle and calm for the duration of the Second World War, or whether they would have their hands full with a rebellious set of colonies in the West Indies during that critical time. And what proved to be the case was that the West Indies swung behind Britain and the British war effort, the imperial kind of war effort, out of both hatred of Nazi philosophy, but also out of a sense of kind of loyalty to the mother country. But it was really important to kind of to place that in the context of these two these two trends, these two things that happen as flip sides of the same coin within the Caribbean in terms of that relationship. On the one hand, a tendency towards rebellion, and quite rightly so, because there was a lot to rebel against. There was a lot of iniquities from the enslavement of Africans beyond slavery to inequalities and poverty and mistreatment. So there was a lot to be rebelled against. But also, often, whilst this was going on, you had you had groups or within the same people a degree of loyalty as well, and swinging behind the various colonial powers in their battles to defend their territories, the use of force in acquiring further territories. And so those two dimensions needed to be placed in context and explained in order to also explain the context of political anxiety and political machination that was going on within Whitehall in order to work out how to manage the rebellious but also loyal West Indian territories.
Absolutely. And I think within that is the history of the West India Regiment. And I think I've spoken about it on the podcast before briefly, but as a military kind of force in the Caribbean, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the kind of early West Indian Regiment and the kind of things that they were doing and the battles that they would have been involved in.
Yeah. And so the from early on as West Indian territories became more and more important to the European powers that conquered them, and because of that, you had European powers that were vying with each other for control of those territories. You had territories moving from one European power to another as through conquest and reconquest and all of that, and so military force was hugely important, both in terms of acquiring those territories, but also then defending them once you had acquired them. Britain, France, and other territories sent huge naval fleets and armies across the Atlantic to the Caribbean for purpose of conquest and for purpose of garrisoning and defending those territories. But over time, it became clear that they could not afford to just keep shipping large numbers of people from Europe. They needed local forces, and there were not enough white people there for those forces just to be white. And so over time, they gradually, reluctantly, but came to the conclusion that they had to engage black people in the defence of those territories as well. These black people at that time were overwhelmingly slaves. They engaged free people, not just whites, but free black people and mixed heritage people in the local militias, but they also turned to slaves as well. And the British Army acquired large numbers of slaves in 1795, created the West India Regiment, which was a regiment of slaves led by white officers, with the British Army becoming one of the biggest slave owners in the world at the time, as it set up and created the West India Regiment. And that was a regiment that was used both defensively to repel foreign powers from British territories within the West Indies, defensively internally to suppress the local population as well, and to maintain control and order for the colonial authorities, but was also used offensively as well over time to acquire territories in other parts of the world. They were a brave brutal, ruthless, and effective force. And it's important to understand the effectiveness of them without glorifying them, because that then tells a lie to some of the mistelling of the story about the effectiveness of West Indian soldiers that seeped into the narrative of First and Second World Wars.
Yeah, that's very interesting, especially when you kind of see that as a longer history, which is, you know, what's been plotted in the book. I wonder, because we have, as you said, you know, you have this narrative of a very effective force in the Caribbean, made up of enslaved Africans and eventually their descendants and Caribbean people. But we get to like this moment in World War II, if we can jump to there, just to bring us to the topic of the book, where, you know, there's a collar bar and they're not accepting black people for service. And it's like, it seems, archivally anyway, it's pitted as a battle between the War Office and the Colonial Office, of, you know, if we're going to accept Caribbean people for service or not. Why is there this disparity, considering especially this long history of black people in service in the Caribbean already?
Yeah, again, that's why this kind of this duality, if you like, within the Caribbean of rebelliousness and loyalty is so important to understand when you look at where these two departments of government stand. So from the War Office perspective, you have not just a racist attitude about racial dominance and stereotyping of different ethnic groups and different people of different colour, but you also have a sense of the role of the army is a global policing role, and that there is something risky about incorporating into that role the very people that you are being called upon to police and to subjugate, etc. And so a real suspicion about taking into their ranks these rebellious people from the West Indies, these people, particularly of African origins within the West Indies, who have been constantly kind of rebelling and have constantly placed pressures on the resources of the War Office of the Army to subdue those rebellions. On the other hand, you have the Colonial Office that oversees the governors and the colonial authorities within the British West Indies, that has got to take a kind of broader picture about how you control those populations. Force is hugely important as a tool of control to the Colonial Office, but it's not the only tool. And if you use that tool excessively, then you lose control. And it recognised that. I mean, throughout the history of the Caribbean, control had been lost in battles between the colonial authorities and enslaved people who rose up and who liberated themselves and who fought the colonial authorities to a standstill. In Jamaica, there are Maroon communities to this day that live in semi-autonomous enclaves where they had secured their, if you like, independence from the British authorities during the period of slavery and signed treaties, which are still recognised to this day and as a sign of what happens when those colonial authorities kind of lose control because they don't apply mechanisms other than sheer force. And so what the Colonial Office needed to do was to have the stick of the army and the navy in one hand, but also wield some of the kind of softer, subtler politics of incorporating those who could be encouraged to be loyal and supportive And there were lots of ways of doing that. And one of the ways was by incorporating into the military services or into certain aspects of civil services, so that they could, these populations or elements of them could be more supportive to the colonial authorities. So the Colonial Office was constantly anxious during the Second World War that the War Office was just far too blinkered in its racism and in the colour bar, and that blinkeredness would alienate the black and brown populations of the Caribbean at a time when it needed them to be on its side. It was just sheer politics that was at play here that drove the Colonial Office to want to take a much more moderated role or much more moderated position on the colour bar than the War Office did.
I wonder, with, you know, all that being said and the kind of pushback, shall we say, of the War Office, as a Caribbean man, woman in the Caribbean, what would then make you want to be part of that? What would make you want to join the war effort? I know there was obviously, you know, back and forth with people choosing to be in the services and those saying, you know, it's a white man's war, it's stay out of it kind of thing. And I wonder as well, in the context of the Caribbean, the labour riots of the 1930s, which would have happened essentially in the years going towards World War II, where, you know, agricultural workers especially were underemployed, unemployed, really poor working conditions, and they had uprisings across the British Caribbean. It's still, by 1939 and into the 40s, the case that people want to join the war effort. Do you know kind of how those things impacted their decision, why they still did it? We know that, you know, so many men and women decided to join the war effort. So what was it that kind of made them do it?
There were tensions. So there were those who argued that, you know, this was an imperialist war, and whilst these imperial powers are ruling, dominating black people in the West Indies, why join their effort in Europe rather than freeing ourselves there? So there were those who refused to support the British war effort on that basis. But the evidence is that the majority took a counter view. The majority view was supportive, either very actively or kind of more tentatively supportive, but supportive nonetheless. As I've mentioned, that was in part out of hatred of the philosophy of Nazism. So the trade union movements that had really kind of built up from the uprisings, the labour uprisings of the 1930s, were strongly opposed to Nazi German philosophy. There was antagonism to Italy and its invasion of Abyssinia or Ethiopia, and these things all kind of played out as part of the mix of therefore who you support. But there was also this element of support to the many of the kind of trappings, the institutions of empire and the mother country. There was one of the tales, I think, in Arthur Lewis's book about the 1930s labour uprisings that he recounts, is in Jamaica, big labour protest in Kingston the striking labour come to a rally. They're being spoken to. They've been addressed by one of the great leaders of the labour movement in Jamaica at the time, Alexander Bustamante, who would become Jamaica's first post independent prime minister. And the crowd started to get a bit unruly during this gathering, and Bustamante's way of trying to calm things down during this period of massive upheaval in the country, protest against British colonial rule and inequalities. And what he does to try and calm them down is to start a verse of God Save the King. That just seems a bit, you know, so on the one hand, you're fighting against empire. On the other hand, you know, this outspoken leader of Labour sees the national anthem, the British national anthem, as a way of unifying the crowd and start, and calming things. Didn't quite work, must be said. It's interesting that speaks to the psychology that there are these trappings of empire and British rule that were nonetheless appealing to and unifying for radical voices within the West Indies. And the academics have written about this. I think Professor Mervyn Elaine wrote about this, talking about, I think the phrase was cultural submersion, where because in the enforced movement and of Africans from Africa to the West Indies, there was this fragmenting of those cultural links to the ethnic groups from which and villages and areas from which they were wrenched, and the need to then form new kind of bonds and allegiances and commonalities within the West Indies. As part of that, there was this superimposing of some of the elements of the dominant normal power entities in terms of the colonial forces. And that's all part of what's built into the complexity around the British West Indian psyche, a psyche of, as I say, rebelliousness, but also still trappings of loyalty to the imperial ruler.
I would definitely concur with that, especially I think thinking about identity, just to move away from war, I guess, for a little bit, but this kind of West Indian identity, it's like an ever-shifting thing. It's molded, as you said, you know, in part by the fact that these are the descendants of people that came over from Africa by force, and then you've got all the other kind of, well, Victorian English Britishness, those values, patriotism, and then you've got this kind of mixing of other cultures coming in from Asia as well, to kind of create this Caribbean place. And then I've also noticed that we could speak about this kind of West Indian identity for this period of people that we're thinking about that might go into service, that are in their 20s or 30s in the 1930s and 40s. But then when you get to the next generation of maybe the children that become the Windrush generation, migrating as younger people that don't necessarily fall into that because they're growing up in a independent Jamaica or a nearly independent St. Kitts. It's like the shift of this kind of identity as generations go on.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think there are generational shifts, always, but I also think that also within generations, you can kind of segment in different ways. So I think that there are class-based issues as well. Poorer people who are living hand to mouth, who have got who see less of the kind of trappings or the benefits or the fruits of colonial rule, were kind of less enamoured of those things than maybe the kind of middle classes or slightly more affluent, and you saw that in the in the First World War and in the way the British West Indies Regiment was created as a kind of a people's army as opposed to the professional army of the West India Regiment, which was seen as a rougher, more aggressive army of tough, poorer West Indians, but that was not seen as the appropriate vehicle for encouraging a slightly kind of expanding middle class black and mixed heritage group to show their loyalty to empire. So you've got all of these things happening as well, which were also part of the Second World War. And that's not to say that poorer people were not also willing to show loyalty to the trappings of empire, but probably less kind of maybe with slightly less enthusiasm than
middle class
groups within those.
Yeah. And maybe other benefits in terms of, you know, professional development, those kinds of things as reasons for joining the war effort might supersede the kind of patriotism as well. The Caribbean, as well as being, you know, a place that gave so much by way of manpower, I've found it interesting to think about the geographical location of the Caribbean and why it was so important for both Britain and then the Allies and then Germany and the Axis powers to keep an eye on this region.
Yeah, and you know, at a time when Britain desperately needed as much support and as much personnel as it could get its hands on during the Second World War, that contribution from the Caribbean was what was important in the armed forces in the UK and in the Caribbean defensively, but also in some of the essential war industries as well, merchant seamen in the munitions factories in Britain. Also, West Indians in large numbers went across to the United States and were providing support in agriculture and in manufacturing, war manufacturing in the United States. But the Caribbean provided two other critical bits of resource for Britain. One was mineral resources. So a third of Britain's oil supply came from the Caribbean, from the oil refineries of Trinidad, the biggest oil producer in the British Empire, and from the oil refineries of the Dutch Caribbean territories of Aruba and Curaçao, which themselves were were refining oil from the wells of Venezuela. But, you know, between them, the refinery complex of Aruba and Curaçao were the biggest in the world. So huge volume of oil they were pumping out, and a third of Britain's oil supply came from those Caribbean oil refineries. And in addition to that, there was bauxite, the ore from which aluminium is produced. You could not build aircrafts without aluminium. So the RAF, in order to function, needed bauxite, needed aluminium to build here its aircrafts. And the Caribbean was virtually the sole source of bauxite for Britain, because after the fall of France, which itself was a bauxite producer, Germany acquired that source of bauxite. America was a producer of bauxite. It did not have enough to export to Britain. In fact, it was a major importer of bauxite from the Caribbean, and Caribbean bauxite was of higher quality than the bauxite in America, and so it was desperate to kind of get a good flow of bauxite from the Caribbean. And it was British Guyana and the Dutch territory of Suriname, which were the two big producers of bauxite. So there was the mineral resource, and then there was the political resource as well, which was the location of the Caribbean. The Caribbean being the only route in to the oil-rich territories of the United States of America on its southern coast. And defensively, Therefore, the Caribbean being a territory that had to be defended by the United States against any kind of foreign aggression, because you have a foreign army there, and they are literally on the front steps of the United States. And so those two things made the Caribbean critically important and useful to Britain. And it was for that reason that the Germans targeted the Caribbean. And so in 1942, the German submarines or U-boats were sent in waves into Caribbean, sunk 337 ships during 1942, turning the Caribbean into the most dangerous shipping zone in the world in 1942. Now, that's hardly a story that's ever told, nor the context around that. And that's what I mean about, you know, narratives that are that become lazy and simplistic and fail to tell the critical role of different parts of the globe, including the Caribbean. And that's why I'm so keen to lend my voice to those historians who are trying to kind of correct that.
It's a world war for a reason, you know. Very, very few corners of the globe that were not involved in some way, shape or form. And I think that speaks to, you know, that you gave like four examples there of the way that the Caribbean was involved. And I think there was also a lot of financial contribution, like literally just giving money and giving resource as well, that, you know, was such a massive contribution to this global conflict. I wondered, and I really liked the fact that you have kind of the narratives of ex-service men and women within this kind of military political history, but you've got the social elements of these stories. And the story of Cy Grant, who ends up as a black prisoner of war in Nazi Germany, which sounds terrifying to me. But actually then, you know, the way it's kind of told is that he's not really dealing with the kind of level of racism that one might expect or you have to deal with in Nazi Germany, bar the American soldier who calls him the N-word. Did it surprise you doing this research and kind of, you know, finding out stories like this? And how does it kind of inform our understanding of maybe racism at this time? And we know the atrocities that Nazi Germany committed, but in this kind of this interesting case of Cy Grant.
Yeah, so I mean, it is quite a striking story, that, isn't it? Unfortunately, there's one element that didn't surprise me, and another element that slightly did. So what did not surprise me was that of the racism that he encountered, it was a fellow American prisoner of war, as you say, using the N-word constantly to refer to him as. That did not surprise me. What surprised me was that it was the only racism that he encountered, and he didn't encounter any racism from his German Nazi prison guards. That was kind of just a really powerful statement of the oddity, the obscenity of kind of race politics, racial positioning in the Western world during that time, particularly in America, where it was more stark. But racial segregation, racial discrimination was not unique to America. It was more blunt in the way America made it happen. And there were other stories that I remember reading when I and Ben were researching my first book, one of which was of a group of African-Americans, African-American soldiers who were on a lunch break and had to sit and eat their lunch outside of a cafe or a diner in one of the southern states of America, which refused to allow black people in, whilst at the same time this diner was allowed in and served German prisoners of war who had been put to work in the field and came into the diner on a break. So the those stark kind of reminders of the utter hypocrisy and lunacy of the position of the Allies around race at a time of fighting this stark kind of proponent of racial superiority. Those just speak volume.
Another thing we found with this kind of work, and I know we started speaking about the first text you worked on with Ben Bousquet, so maybe people aren't really thinking that women are left out the narrative of kind of contributions to World War II, but they are often left out of the narratives. They're left out of historical narratives more broadly, but especially when it comes to World War II. I'm still surprised at how shocked people are when I say Caribbean women were part of the war effort. And people like how, where, you know, and just, you know, it wasn't necessarily frontline battle, but they were definitely part of it. With that first text, West Indian Women at War, British Racism in World War II, why did you decide to focus your research on that? And then were you surprised at all by the things you were finding out about West Indian women and their contribution to the war, both at home and abroad, as they travelled quite a lot to be part of the service?
So we landed on that almost by accident, because Ben happened across some old copies of Picture Post during back copies of Picture Post during the Second World War, and one of which had a feature on a group of West Indian women who had travelled to Britain, who were recruited in the British West Indies and brought to Britain in the ATS. And we thought, this was complete news to us. We weren't aware of that at all, and we thought, that's really interesting. Let's look into this, and let's do a bit more digging. So that's how we kind of got into that. It was a story that was entirely new to us. We had no knowledge of the contribution of West Indian women in the services. We were familiar with stories of the RAF and also contribution to other aspects of services by men, but not of women. And actually there was this significant recruitment of 600 people into the ATS from the Caribbean. 200 went to Washington DC, 100 were stationed in the Caribbean, and 300 were brought to the United Kingdom. This was even more significant than the numbers, because the politics around it and the battle royal that was fought between Colonial Office and War Office was fascinating to us and was eye-opening to us as we dig beneath the surface. And subsequently kind of found out about many more areas in which women contributed to the war effort, in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force as well, the Women's Branch of the RAF, and in other branches of the war service. But the other thing that was that's really important and is ignored is that broader role of women in war. So in order for men to join combat units in large numbers, what happens to all of those essential functions that they walk away from, most essential of which was producing food? So in the Caribbean, at the start of the war, when governors were asked, when the idea was floated of creating a West Indian regiment of some sort, a new kind of combat regiment, which would take years to come to fruition. But when that idea was first floated, a caveat that was placed was, but you must be able to ensure this does not stand in the way of agricultural self-sufficiency, of food self-sufficiency. It's essential that the islands produce produce food, because food is already short, and we can't allow this to be an even greater drain on agricultural production. And I think it was the governor of St. Lucia who responded to that round robin kind of message from the colonial office, and other governors would have reached similar conclusion. And he said, won't be a problem, because actually women play a major role in agriculture here, and so we can free up large numbers of young men to join the forces. And so in lots of ways like this, you have hidden stories, yeah, of which are about wars are fought by entire populations. They are not fought just by fighting forces, just by those who carry guns, yep, and weapons into battle. They're fought by the entirety of the population. And the role of women in that is still desperately understated. I'm really pleased that the first book that I did with Ben was specifically looking at the role of women, because it's broadened my tenor in terms of looking out for, well, you know, war is this broader thing than the way it tends to be presented in wartime histories. But I think it is still desperately understated in our understanding of the Caribbean contribution to the war effort.
Yeah, absolutely. I would definitely agree. I think it's interesting the way that these histories, as you've spoken about, have such a contemporary relevance and shape our understanding of the region and of World War II more broadly. And we started with kind of thinking about this kind of Windrush generation and this post-war migration that happens from the Caribbean. The newsreel, the Pathé newsreel of the Windrush arriving is for what he says, so many ex-servicemen coming from Jamaica, and you know, they've come for work and things like that. And there, I think the link between the Windrush migrations and those that followed, and you know, the World War II and the servicemen, especially in the Windrush reel, because it only actually shows men and there are no mention of ex-service women or anything like that. But this link is there. It's, you know, it can't be broken. A lot of people are coming back following service in Britain or following an experience, a professional experience working during World War II. And you end the book with a line that you say, this was a continuation of the British Caribbean experience, fighting with Britain during global wars and during times of peace, fighting British authorities for justice. And I think it so beautifully spoke to the kind of entirety of the book and things we've spoken about today, of this spirit of rebellion and the way in which people in the Caribbean have picked, you know, where they're going to fight and who they're going to fight against and when they're going to fight for you. Was this link in your mind when you were writing? You know, were you thinking about the Windrush and the post-war migrations, and I guess the reason we're all here today? How does that all kind of link up?
Because I think it's a constant theme throughout the history of the Caribbean under European conquest. It's that theme of kind of loyalty and rebellion, that theme of fighting with the alongside your colonial ruler in repelling others, but then fighting against once that task has been done, and you then need to still work through the injustices that ruler is imposing on you. And that phrase towards the end of my book about fighting with during times of battle and then fighting for justice afterwards was a reflection as the narrative kind of brought us up to the Windrush scandal of 2018, which itself was a consequence of layer upon layer of racist immigration laws being put in place from the 1960s onwards, that meant that West Indians who arrived holding British passports pre-independence, even those who arrived pre-independent with British passports, were then having their right to stay questioned decades afterwards as a consequence of the erosion of those automatic rights by racist immigration legislation, and were being denied access to services, were losing their jobs, and in some cases being sent to the Caribbean. Just the most appalling failure of the state in regard to these people. And it was just this classic continuation of the utter insult to a group of people who travelled to this country at a time when this country was in desperate need of manpower and woman power to support rebuilding of British infrastructure and institutions after the war. Yes, there was also a need for employment in those West Indian territories which were starved of employment opportunity. But you know, over here there was in the year or two after the war, the Ministry of Labour was estimated that there were more than a million short in terms of labour. So there was a desperate call for labour. Weren't able to get all of the labour that was required from Europe, from European refugees and from others. And so turned to the Caribbean, to India, to Africa, to those parts of the empire for support, and then having got that support, treated them so badly. It's an absolute disgrace that should never be forgotten.
Absolutely, and I think with that in mind, with that very thing in mind, when I wrote this question, I think that was what was going through my head, but. Hypothetically speaking, and you don't have to speak for yourself here, but I mean, just a kind of assumption. If we found, or if Britain found itself in a similar conflict today as they did in 1939, would Caribbean people, and maybe here in Britain or back in the Caribbean, support Britain as they did in the past, do you think?
So I think that we now... live in an age where that population that is more that will be called upon to fight, that younger population, will be far more challenging and sceptical about the cause for which they are called upon to fight. And I think that's black, brown. But white people as well. I think we are we're in an age where we're actually, you know, because you have a jingoistic call to battle, that's not enough. What's the cause? And if the cause is just, then you will get many people volunteering without being conscripted. But if it is not. Yeah. You will get not just a refusal to join, you will get protest against the war as well.
Brilliant. That was a really good answer. I think you answered that better for my generation, who might be the age of people being called to fight, than I could. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The cause would be in question, and it was one of the reasons that people in the Caribbean, you know, chose to be part of that, the cause, absolutely. I think that is everything that I wanted to ask you about your work and about the book and about the Caribbean and the Second World War. I wondered, is there anything else you wanted to leave us with, or if I have pressed you enough for answers to my many, many questions?
I think my one kind of big reflection from writing these books, the latest one and the previous one, is that because histories of the Second World War, which is big, complex, global conflict, because they are so partial, Because the partial nature of them is driven by this desire for to simplify, but also because of bias, because they're written from the perspective of the kind of the egos of the nations that are dominant in writing them. It's really important that we kind of constantly are willing to probe, to peel off the outer layers and look beyond and look deep into histories to understand them, and to recognise that histories, because they've been written, are not set in stone. They're not yep. done deals. The ink is not dry. They're not infallible. Mm. They can be challenged and developed, and in fact, they have to be. And so my reflection is that we should all appreciate that history is a working draft. It's not the final version. It's a working draft. If we're interested in it, if we want to research it, if we want to challenge and come up with different dimensions, that's how the working draft improves and gets better and better. It will never get to a final, finished, polished place. But seeing it as a working draft is the best way of engaging with history.
Brilliant. I think that's words to live by. And for me, with my PhD, history is a working draft. It doesn't need to be perfect. Oh, no, that makes complete sense. It is really, really true. As you've said, and, you know, to many, many more revisions as we find out new things and access new archives. Thank you so much, Colin, for joining me today on the podcast. If you are interested in getting The Caribbean and the Second World War, it's published by Lawrence Wishart, and I will have purchase places in the show notes below. Thank you so much for joining me, Colin. I hope all of you listening have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.